Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Talking the Cure, Home Lawyers, Life Sciences and Healthcare Podcast. I've done it again. I'm going to continue my journey and talk to partners about their work, their passion, their life. And I had her on a couple of weeks ago, and I took the chance because she was on my list from the beginning I started the series. But I knew that she was is so incredibly busy that I didn't want to bother her for a long time and ask her to come on. So today is the day, and I'm super happy to have her. Alice Valdekeren, thank you very much for taking the time and joining me on this podcast. And as I told you in the beginning, I'm super bad in introducing people, and we're going to do a deeper dive in your career and why you're so passionate about what you do. Just give a quick, brief introduction before we kick it off.
Sure. My name's Alice Valdekeren. I'm a partner in the Hogan Lovells Health Practice. I work exclusively with pharmaceutical manufacturers around commercialization and market access issues, with a particular focus on drug pricing.
Thank you. That was really brief. Before I ask you a couple of more questions in regards of life sciences and specific matters, can you provide an overview of your career, especially what I'm always keen to learn about, what inspired you to pursue this kind of job and to become a lawyer?
So my dad was a lawyer. My dad was a plaintiff's malpractice lawyer. So for those of you outside the U.S., that means that he represented individuals who were injured by actions that their healthcare providers took that they believed were below the standard of care. My dad went to a year of medical school before he decided to be a lawyer. And one of the challenges of doing that sort of law, and he wasn't always that kind of lawyer. He sort of became that sort of lawyer after practicing for maybe 10 years. And one of the challenges of that, which I really appreciate as an adult, is that the work is done on a contingency fee basis exclusively, which means you meet clients, you take the cases you think you can win, and you pretty much only get paid if you win or settle. And he was the sole breadwinner in our family. So that meant that he had some big paydays, but they were few and far between. I mean, he was very successful, but they were still very few and far between. And it takes someone who's quite confident in their judgment and how things are going to turn out to raise and support a family doing that sort of work and be quite successful with it, too. So I grew up doing that. And you can think of course, you became a lawyer because your father was a lawyer. But even when I was growing up, women were not the majority group of people going through law school and becoming professionals. And so I have two older brothers. They didn't become lawyers. I was the one who became the lawyer. So that it certainly, I was lucky enough to have someone who I could see as a role model, and I could see how he did it. So that's why I went to law school. And then after that, I graduated from law school. I clerked for a judge for a year. He was a wonderful man. He's still on the court, Royce Lamberth, on the D.C. District Court here in Washington, D.C. And then I went to work for the Department of Justice, and I was a litigator. There's something called the Honor Program where you go in, and I did False Claims Act civil enforcement work. So I was a prosecutor going after healthcare fraud, defense procurement fraud. And the benefit of that part of my career is you get hands-on experience because you are leading the case, you are writing the briefs, you are making the decisions, you are taking the depositions, and you're doing all of that when you're barely out of law school. And I got trial experience. I got first chair trial experience when I was about 3 years out of law school. So, and working, just with wonderful people and really smart lawyers at the Department of Justice who, I'm often on the other side of, but I still have immense admiration for because they're very good at what they do, and they do it because they believe in what they do. And then I had my first child and realized that I didn't want to travel, like I was going to have to travel, or I was having to travel when I worked at the Department of Justice, and I wanted to work part-time. And this was the late 90s. And people were starting to work part-time, but it was not done particularly well. It's still not necessarily always done particularly well. And so I talked to a bunch of firms, and then Hogan and Hertzen was the only firm that was remotely rational in how they did it, which is if you worked a percentage of the target, you got paid a percentage of the salary. And in general, at least in my experience, if you worked more than that, they trued you up. And I won't go into the other firms or why it wasn't rational, but it wasn't. But that's why I came to Hogan and Hertzen of all the firms. And I had, you know, I was a good person to recruit because I had first year trial experience having only been a few years out of law school. And so, and that's what got me to this firm was because of their willingness to be rational and reasonable and try to make it work.
And you got into the industry of life sciences immediately or were just...
So what's interesting is that whole part of my career has nothing to do with what I do now. And at some point I had to make a major pivot. And so when I came to Hogan and Hertzen, I worked for a white collar partner named Steve Immelt, who became our CEO many years later, working on white collar matters for him. And a lot of those matters related with our life sciences clients. And so I sat with the health practice, even though I was in the white collar team, and was elevated to counsel at some point in time. And I remember thinking as I was counsel, what is my business case going to be to become a partner? I was smart enough at that point to realize that you actually do have to think about that. And I thought to myself, there are all these really good white collar lawyers who are more senior than me. Why is anyone going to hire me to do that when they can hire Steve Immelt or, you know, my colleague, Mitch Lazarus, who I work with a lot now? Why would I get elevated to partner? And I had always done work with the health practice to fill in time when I was slow or when there were issues to be done, handled that were adjacent to the investigation matters I was handling. And so I'd gotten to know those partners quite well. And there was a partner who had been handling government pricing matters for pharmaceutical companies under a statute that was relatively new. And that partner wanted to pivot her practice to focus more on this new statute that had just been enacted called HIPAA, which is the big healthcare privacy law here in the United States. And so she wanted to focus on that, which meant she wasn't going to be able to focus so much on pricing. And I had done some work with her. And so I had this opportunity to sort of step into that practice and gradually take it over and lead it. And I remember that she and I went in to speak with a senior partner in the practice who had done some work in the pricing area too, to tell her that the current partner was going to step back and I was going to step into it as a counsel and take it on. And the senior partner was rather annoyed because it meant that she was going to have to retrain or train someone anew. But I was interested in doing it because I knew that I could learn the four corners of the statute and all the guidance so I could learn it substantively. I knew how to sell it. I knew every drug company in the country needed this expertise, and I knew it was specific enough, complicated enough that they were never going to be able to do it entirely in-house, so they were always going to need external support. And I thought, I now know what my business case can be. And more importantly, for someone who was still working part-time, I can charge more for my time because this is a niche practice with expertise. And even if I work fewer hours than the typical partner, I can still generate the same amount of revenue because I'm charging more per hour. And so the business case is going to write itself. So that is in short how I ended up stepping into that practice. And the regulation of drug pricing and commercialization of drugs in the U.S. market has only increased in the 20 plus years since I've been doing that. And as that has expanded, my practice has expanded as well.
You already covered a bit the area of law you specialize in and you work on. When you take a look at the cases you do and the clients, what is the ones you're the most passionate about and what is the most common thing you work on normally?
I'm going to answer that question a little bit in reverse. I'll say the punchline is the work that's most interesting is the work that involves the most innovation, where the innovation of our clients with the products they generate requires innovation in the law that we practice. But before you can do that sort of work, I want to impress upon everyone the importance of knowing the basics. And knowing the basics of what you do is not the sexiest work. Knowing the basics of how the statutes work in my practice, how the prices need to be calculated, how you count them, what's in, what's out, understanding the Excel spreadsheets that walk through the formulas for how to calculate the prices. Understanding all of those details is not sexy. It requires really understanding the client's business. And the arcane rules that the government puts in place. But understanding that having those two pillars, a really strong foundation in the nuts and bolts of what the law provides, and understanding how the business of getting pharmaceutical and biotechnology products from the manufacturing floor into patients, only by really understanding that work do you have the capability to work on the really interesting matters of first impression, whether it's a new product that has to create a new model for how products get to patients or how they're priced, whether it's taking a new statutory requirement and applying it to a commercial marketplace that the statutory requirement doesn't comprehend or contemplate. You have to have a grounding in those fundamentals to be able to do that work. Because I think everyone would say the innovative work, issues of first impression with new laws or new sorts of products, is going to be the most interesting. But the only reason you can do that is because you've done all the hard work of really understanding the basics. And so I don't want to leave that part out. And as for those issues can be presented by single product companies that don't have a product on the market yet. I worked with my partner, Ken Cho, on a really interesting, challenging project for a client that is pre-commercial, that was having some challenging pricing modeling issues, how they were going to price their product. We had to come up with some innovative solutions for that versus some of the biggest companies in the world that are dealing with the Inflation Reduction Act and what it means for their business and in everything in between. So it's not just a certain type of client that brings those issues. It can be anyone. And you can find innovation and issues of first impression all across that.
That was pretty theoretical and pretty vague.
Sure. I'm happy to give you examples if you want examples of interesting work.
That would be my follow-up question. So when you take a look back on the work you've done so far, maybe we can pick out one or two cases that you feel like were the most challenging or interesting cases where we can build a foundation so people fully understand what you're dealing with and what are the highlights, you would say, and tell at the dinner table when somebody is asking you what you actually do.
Sure. So a clear career highlight for me was the multiple best prices reporting option that the Medicaid program codified in regulation a couple of years ago and was a new pricing model that I worked on with my partner, Ken Cho, to create. And we created a coalition across four clients to take that to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services as a new innovative value-based pricing model for cell and gene therapies to enable value-based pricing for those therapies in a way that the existing regulatory scheme really wouldn't accommodate. So we came up with a creative way to interpret the statute. We thought through operationally how it could be implemented. We went with our clients to the agency to explain why this would work within the statute. It didn't require a change in law, why it furthered their policy goals, how it would be operationalized under other aspects of the regulatory scheme. And then things sort of went dark and we just didn't know what the agency was doing. And then one day, CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, issued a proposed rule in Medicaid, and they included this idea in their proposed regulation. And I was sitting at my desk, and it was around dinner time, and I think I said something like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." And my kids were like, "What happened? What happened? What happened, Mom?" And I'm like, "You don't understand what just happened." I had no idea this was coming. We had no idea that CMS was going to embrace this and propose it as its own. And it was, you know, pretty much straight up what we had worked so hard in a collaborative way with our clients to propose and to see that, have the agency adopt that and propose it was amazing. And then ultimately they finalized it. So, you know, the way it works in the U.S. is you propose a regulation, you let stakeholders comment, and then the agency decides whether to finalize it as is or with tweaks, and they pretty much finalize it as is. And that was just immensely rewarding because it did create a new pathway to enable value-based pricing, which is a huge challenge for these biblical therapies that we now see in the marketplace, where we literally have cures of diseases that no one thought was curable. But they have a very high price tag as a result. They typically are one and done treatments. You take them once and then they have their result. And so patients and their health plans understandably only want to have to pay for it if it works, which means they want a significant discount or money back if it doesn't. And our regulatory scheme didn't really make that a possibility. And so to be able to build on the amazing innovation in the scientific sphere to generate these products to cure patients or to have such an impact on patients, to be able to use that to come up with an innovative solution in the regulatory context was pretty awesome. So that's one example I can give you.
That's super interesting, especially since it's now written in the history of law and you can always showcase for it and say, hey, this is actually something we've done. Anything else? Similar level of excitement?
Not a similar level of excitement in terms of a clear outcome. And part of that's the nature of what I do, right? Most of what I do is in the background working with clients on strategies to help patients access their therapies. So you're not going to have a court decision that you can point to. You're not going to have a deal announcement that you can point to. So there's not a lot that I can say publicly. But when I think about the kind of work that I find most fulfilling, it inevitably is work that involves collaboration with clients, but also with other folks here at Hogan Lovells. And a big project that we did recently was in relation to the rollout of the Inflation Reduction Act drug price negotiation provisions. So the Inflation Reduction Act, in case you've been living under a rock, is this new statute in the United States that, among other things, for the very first time, empowers the Medicare program to negotiate drug prices with manufacturers in the U.S. And in, I guess, Q2 of this year, the Medicare program issued their first round of guidance on how they were going to implement this program, and had a very short timeline for stakeholders, including manufacturers, to submit comments on this guidance. And the import of this guidance cannot be overstated, but it was a issue of first impression for everyone. And we put together a team here at the firm that included me and Ken Cho, a number of associates and counsel in our health practice, but we also worked very closely with folks in our pharmaceutical regulatory practice, the folks who work with the FDA, for example, here in the US, because there are a number of issues there that we had to work through that were really thorny, really complicated. No one had ever had to think about. I also ended up working with some of our intellectual property colleagues, because there's some intellectual property strategy issues that are implicated by this program. And getting to work with those really smart people and talk through issues for the first time, figure out what it meant for our clients and what they should be advocating for, figuring out how to write it all up, get it to them so that they could socialize it with their internal clients and get it over the finish line, was an enormous effort. And I don't think anyone else could have done it the way we did it here at Hogan Lovells, because we take for granted the collaborative way that we work. I don't think everyone else works that way. But we do. And it's not only more fun and more fulfilling to feel like you're part of a team working with really smart people where we all admit we don't know what the answer is because it's all new, but to figure out those answers together, or what we think the best answers are, is about as good as it gets for what we do.
I don't want to hit the marketing drum too hard, but I think it's a major advantage when you just can go kind of down the hall and knock on your colleague's door, who's also in the life sciences industry group, but has another practice which touches with your case, right?
That's why I do what I do where I do it.
Okay. Now we get a little bit more into the trenches here. So obviously many people pursue a career in law, but it takes a lot of effort and engagement and sweat and tears to get to the level that you are? And what drives you to get there? And especially what motivates you on a day-to-day basis based on the hours, not part-time anymore? Give us a couple of more insights why you do what you do.
Ultimately, I think it's the relationships I have with the clients I work with. I think all of us work our hardest when we want to support someone we care about on something that's important to us. But foundationally, what gets me to work as hard as I do and care about the quality of work I do and doing it at the pace that's required is because I want to support the people I work closely with at all of these companies. I really try to put myself in their shoes, understand what they need in order to meet their needs, and gauge my response time, the quality of what I give by, you know, it's the golden rule. Like, what would I want someone to do for me? And that's really what drives me, is wanting to support these folks and what they do because I believe in what they're doing. And these products that come out, you know, just in my lifetime as a lawyer, the pharmaceutical market and the types of products we see and their impact is so revolutionary. When you actually stop and think about the impacts that they have on patient lives, it's pretty incredible. You know, I don't even want to say I contribute to that, because what I do is so much on the back end and all the science has been done. But to even be able to say I'm affiliated with that effort, to be able it's a privilege. It's a real privilege to be able to do the small, tiny part that I do to help it get to patients and to be able to help the people I care about at my client, whose responsibility it is too.
I talked to your fellow partner, Randy, two weeks ago, and he said something which stuck with me, and I want to hear your view about it. They said, it's so interesting to see the changes that are happening from treating people to curing people in lines of products and how companies approach the science behind all of this.
It's really true. We just never thought we would ever be in that space. And part of it is not just about these products themselves, but how it's going to change our healthcare system, because you're seeing a shift in the way money is spent in the healthcare system, because you used to have to spend a lot of time and money on provider care. So being in a hospital or having a surgery or going to see your doctor or having some procedure done. And the development of pharmaceuticals or medical devices, in Randy's case, are moving more and more of that care out of the provider setting and into a syringe or into a bottle or you know, some other drug-based therapy, that we are seeing where costs are incurred shift just because we are seeing these advancements in the therapies that our clients can bring to market. And so it's also changing the landscape of the healthcare system as well.
Yeah, that's true. Didn't thought about that. See, I already learned another thing and a couple of views I can drop down on another person in the next interview. As a partner in such a prestigious and diverse law firm, I said it in my question a couple of minutes ago, you face a pretty demanding workload. And In addition to your workload, you have to coordinate with all the rest of your team and figure out, okay, how we are able to manage all this stuff. I always ask, since it's a new thing coming up, even when it's not, but it is, work-life balance. You told me that you made the decision to join the firm based on the fact that you were able to work part-time to take care of your kids. How do you, but I know you, and I think I know you now for 9 years, I think, and you would constantly travel around the world and say, yeah, Alice is in London, Alice is in Asia somewhere. And it's like, how do you maintain your work-life balance and such a high level of performance, and you're constantly somewhere talking to somebody?
So I think it varies based on where you are in your career. So as I mentioned earlier, I did come to the firm to work part-time, and I worked part-time until I went into leadership and was doing a lot of remote working before I went into leadership of the firm. I was had a leadership position at the firm for about 6 years. So before then, I was always part-time, and the beauty of the billable hour is it doesn't really matter when or where it occurs. And I worked from home frequently because that was what enabled me to manage what I had to manage. I'll also say, and I think this is important, that I never let the fact that I worked a reduced schedule define me as a lawyer. I was just really good at what I did. It didn't matter whether I was working 100% or if I was working 75%. What mattered is that my clients experienced had a good experience with me. And so I just figured out what I needed to do and I did it. It's going to differ for every single person based on what they need in their lives. So I guess my message for that part of my life is you figure out what you need and you do it. And you talk to the people that you work with to make it work. Communication is key. People have to know when you can work, when you can't, that you're going to make a deadline if you need to make the deadline. But if you can manage that communication front, you just figure out how you need to structure your life and work with your internal and external clients around that. When I was in leadership, that's when I was doing all that traveling that you're talking about. I actually did a lot less practice then than I'm doing now. And the key then was really to have a team and have a really good team around me to help keep me organized. And since I'm back and out of leadership and practicing full time now, for the first time really ever in my career, am I doing 100% client facing on my schedule? Because I wasn't doing that before, either before leadership or during leadership. I don't even know how I would describe my work-life balance. I feel like people always feel like they're not doing a good job at it. I certainly feel like I'm always somewhat failing at it. I'm probably doing a better job at it than I think I am. But I would, mostly say, listen to what you need. And when you need a break, you need to take a break. And if you're worried about managing things with your clients, you need to talk to your clients about it because they're people too. And my guess is that they care about you as much as you care about them. And if you tell them that you need to take some time off or not even taking time off, but you're managing your own schedule and that's going to affect deadlines, they are almost always open to those conversations because they have to deal with exactly the same thing. And assuming that you're in general meeting whatever demands they have, the occasional request for some flexibility because you need it is not going to be a problem. You just have to be willing to have a conversation with them about it. And they're typically, at least in my experience, they're going to try to accommodate you if they can.
Since they appreciate the work you do and they hired you for a reason.
Yeah, and you have a relationship with them. A relationship with them.
Would that advice, and I take it more likely as an advice, be some part of when you would talk to aspiring lawyers in your team, associates who joined, and they are hoping for a similar level of success in the legal profession? And are there other insights you can give? I said, okay, these are my top 5 tips to survive.
First of all, you can do it. Like I tell people this all the time. I am just Alice. I am Alice Walter Curran. I have managed to be where I am by doing what I'm doing. And I don't know that there's any secret sauce other than just working really hard. But I think to be a law firm partner anywhere, the abiding bit of advice I would have is extreme discipline and always delivering excellent work. It is really hard to get into the habit of delivering excellent work every single time. Not just when you remember, not just when you have enough time, but forcing yourself to take the time every time you're having a conversation with a client, you're drafting an email, you're doing written work product, that you address every issue that needs to be addressed. You address it fully. You don't sort of you know, do it a little bit and think it's good enough. It's really forcing yourself to track down every detail to make sure it is site checked, that you fix that or you fix this formatting, that it looks good visually. And that's really hard to develop that discipline. And you do have to develop it because we can always find excuses why we don't have to do that. But to me, what is the hallmark of a lawyer that I want to work with every single time, even in the my own firm or other firms that I collaborate with, it's the person that I know is going to deliver excellent work every single time, and I can completely trust them that they will do that. And to that end, I emphasize that because I remember when I learned that lesson. I think I was either a senior associate or maybe a counsel at the time, and I was doing a memo for a retired partner named Bob Kenny, who was in our government contracts practice. And he asked me to do a memo on an issue. And I think I don't know if it related to pricing or it was another project. And I remember having to stay up late to work on this memo and thinking to myself, oh yeah, I probably should deal with that. Oh yeah, I've read it again and I should probably deal with that. And I remember that was the memo where I forced myself to deal with every single one of those issues that cropped up as I worked through that document. I forced myself to do it. And Bob noticed, and he really, he didn't overly praise me, but I knew I had done that. And I knew what the difference it was and the difference it made in that work product. And to me, that's the lesson I teach more junior lawyers more than any, is you really have to fix every detail every time to practice at the level that I think our clients expect us to practice.
I'm super happy that this story had a positive turning and not something post-traumatic, post-traumatic thing that.
No, but I will say, but Julius, I will say there have been times where that has helped me because there have been questions about the work I've done, and to be able to go back and to prove that I've dotted every I and crossed every T has been really important. And so it does have a protective effect, but more importantly, it's the pride in your work that you know that you've really delivered really quality work product. That is, to one of your earlier questions, why I do what I do.
Thanks for sharing. That gives me good insights. But getting back to your life sciences expertise, the industry is constantly evolving, and we talked a bit about the change from treatment to curing. How do you stay up to date? I assume you talk a lot to your clients, and since they are in the forefront of what's going on in the industry, you got a lot of insights. But how does this overall impact your approach regarding client representation?
So I was really glad you provided the questions ahead of time so I could think about my answers. And on the question of the future for both as a legal practitioner and the life sciences industry, I started by thinking about the trends in the legal industry, and I realized that they're going to impact the life sciences industry in the same way. First and foremost is the impact of technology and AI. You know, I went to college when the internet was just becoming a thing, and I had a laptop in law school, and I was one of the few people that had my own laptop. It probably weighed about 10 pounds, but I had a laptop.
Yeah, I would say if you needed a trailer with it for your car,
it wasn't quite that bad, but it was heavy. And so the technology development and the AI, and I say about my history because I am not a digital native, and I know that I personally could do a lot more with technology if I took the time to learn it. And I think the current, the more junior lawyers who are digital natives, this is all second nature, and they take to this technology really easily, and they're going to take to the AI algorithms and how it impacts practice more readily than I can. But that is going to change how we practice law, and it's going to change what people pay lawyers to do versus what they don't pay lawyers to do. And we have to, as lawyers, as business people, be thinking about how that's going to impact our business model, because it will. There's also the topic of there's just more regulation coming. I mean, I'm a regulatory lawyer, so I'm going to tell you there's more regulation, but I don't think I'm making that up. And in the life sciences industry, both of these things are also true. We are definitely going to see technology and AI change the life sciences industry. We're already seeing how it impacts identification of product molecules that they're going to target and develop. You know, we hear about these companies that are running algorithms against libraries of molecules to see which ones they're going to use to try for new indications that haven't been looked at before. And we're also going to see more regulation in the life sciences industry. I mean, we see the Inflation Reduction Act and what it's doing with drug price negotiation. We're seeing more and more states get into the mix, trying to set caps on drug prices in their states. So, and the reason we're seeing that is, I think, part of that trend that I talked about earlier, which is more and more of our healthcare spend is going towards therapies and devices rather than human-based service delivery. And you combine that with the fact that these products are, in some ways, I mean, they're not widgets, but you have one item with one price. And so it's much easier to regulate nationwide than how much a doctor charges for this in one state versus that in another state. So it's much easier to regulate. And so when you see increasing costs for all the right reasons in the life sciences sector because of the advances in therapies that we have, and you see that cost shift then into a category of care that's easier to regulate because it's a single price, or you know they view it as easier to regulate, we're just going to see more of it. And that means that I think more and more companies are going to have to continue to focus on getting regulatory advice and thinking about how that increase in regulation impacts everything they do. So that's what I see for the future of the legal profession, but also the life sciences industry.
Thank you. You more likely, and that's where I was said, oh man, why did I share the questions in advance? But since you already took my, give me the vision of the future, you left something out. That's the one we should cover before we come to an end. So what's in there for you?
I just enjoy working with the people I work with who bring these therapies to patients. I like seeing how the industry is evolving, and I like seeing how I can help them achieve that goal. When you think about all of the effort that goes into the science to create these therapies that improve patient lives and sometimes even cure them, it boggles the mind, the level of effort, trial and error, perseverance, investment. It is such a privilege to be able to come in really at the tail end. And the process is so long that tail end could still be 2 or 3 years, but to be able to come in at the tail end and help those therapies actually get into patients, it's a privilege. So that's what I do. That's why I do what I do.
And you're going to continue to do that?
I am.
Nice. All right, Alice, thank you very much for taking the time. I am happy that you agreed to talk to me because I learned a lot about you, and I hope our listeners will appreciate it as well. So for everyone listening, thank you very much for joining us, and we're happy to have you back in the next couple of weeks. And don't forget to subscribe, give us a 5-star review, and subscribe to LinkedIn, Twitter, because we're sharing news constantly. We are obviously going to link Alice's contacts in the show notes. So if you have questions, please feel free to reach out to her. Alice, again, thank you very much. And we are each other in a couple of weeks when we're back at Talking the Cure. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.